Let's face it, our industry's General Hospital is OpenAI at this point. It is the soap opera of our industry.
Yes. But like all good sitcoms, we started somewhere, things happened, and we ended up exactly where we started off to begin with. So there we go, ladies and gentlemen. OpenAI part 495, I think.
Next week, tomorrow, on General OpenAI Hospital.
We need some dramatic
Will
shots.
Sam.
I get
tell all.
When in doubt, talk about OpenAI because there's always something going on.
This Week in Startups is brought to you by Vanta. Compliance and security shouldn't be a deal breaker for startups to win new business. Vanta makes it easy for companies to get a SOC 2 report fast. Twist listeners can get $1,000 off for a limited time at vanta.com/twist. LinkedIn ads. To redeem a $100 LinkedIn ad credit and launch your first campaign, go to linkedin.com/thisweekinstartups. And Equinix. The Equinix Startup Program offers a hybrid infrastructure solution for startups, including up to $100K in credits and personalized consultations and guidance from the Equinix team. Go to equinixstartups.com to apply today.
Hey, everybody. Hey, everybody. Welcome to a very special edition of This Week in Startups. I am so excited that Alex Wilhelm is joining us today, not as a guest, but as our new co-host. And we've got a ton to talk about. You know, Alex has been on the program, God, at least a dozen times doing these roundtables, at least. And I've spent the last 4 or 5 years trying to get him to quit TechCrunch and Crunchbase and join me here. And finally, he decided it's time. So welcome as co-host, not just guest.
No, I'm incredibly excited to be here. I freaking love podcasting. I love business. I love startups. I love talking about it. Honestly, Jason and I have been kicking it for a long time. And so now we're going to do it quite often. News roundtables, interviews. We have a whole slate of things planned for the show. Yes. It's going to be absolutely awesome.
And it's great because you and I have a great back and forth of rapport on these subjects. You're a challenging person to do this with because your knowledge level is so high. Usually in these discussions, I'm up against somebody who maybe is deferring to me. Hey, you have more experience. You have tons of experience in this. You've been covering this at TechCrunch, Crunchbase, and everything in between. So it's just really great to have you here. And I'm really excited for a great summer. Twice a week, minimum news.
Yes.
And we'll do it live sometimes. And so if you have questions, join us in YouTube, LinkedIn, or Twitter. He's at Alex. I'm at Jason. Think about that. I mean, we both have our first names on X.
Which is just evidence of our intense nerdery and the fact that we've been doing this for a very long time. I will try to live up to your kind words. But the good news is there is so much going on already, even for this early in the week.
Yeah. So why don't you tell everybody what's on the docket today, and then we'll go right to our first story.
Yeah. Okay. So first thing we're going to talk about today is OpenAI equity clawbacks and essentially when you can talk smack about your former employer and how to do damage control live, then AI revenue. We have some data on the consumer side. We'll talk about what's going on the enterprise side of things. I'm a little bit surprised to see how well consumer is doing compared to business. We'll talk about that. Then there is a big deal in cybersecurity showing that there's a lot of consolidation going on. Not a lot of IPOs, but we are seeing some movements in SaaS that I want to talk about. Then Jason wanted this in the show today. How much are founders paying themselves and what is reasonable? I think he'll have a couple of things he wants to say about that. And then venture interest in crypto. And then we're going to do a very quick tease and a reminder to everybody that this is NVIDIA earnings week. Everyone's going to be tuned into that, Jason, but I think we have to wait until Wednesday.
Yeah, and I think we should probably go live right after that. That might be a fun thing for us to do because you and I love to geek out on the 10 Qs and kind of read the tea leaves in these product announcements and financial quarterly announcements. There's just so much information buried in those docs, and it's a lot of fun because you have the scoreboard of the stock price, you know, as a backdrop as opposed to private companies where, you know, the valuations don't change all that often. Let's get into this OpenAI equity issue because this brouhaha, this Donnybrook, has been going all over Twitter and social media and tech meme. Everybody's got something to say about this because I think there's a wider issue here. And let's face it, our industry's General Hospital is OpenAI at this point. It is the soap opera of our industry.
Yes. When in doubt, talk about OpenAI because there's always something going on. So there's two things going on here, Jason. One, there have been a couple of exits from OpenAI, including on their quote super alignment team, people thinking about privacy and safety. We'll get to that in a second. But when one of the people exited, Vox wrote a piece describing essentially an agreement inside their exit deals with their former employees that if there was any disparagement ever, they could get their vested equity clawed back. And why does that matter? And also vested versus unvested, how common is this setup amongst other companies that you've seen?
Yeah, so this is common and it tends to be reciprocal. So it's not as one-sided or as bad as it sounds. First of all, when you leave a company and it's on good terms, bad terms, whatever it is, a company can decide that, and you can decide, it's double opt-in here in America, and we're talking about the American market. Okay, it doesn't work out, whatever the reason. The company might say, hey, you know what? We'll give you 6 months of severance and we'll vest, you know, your remaining 2 years of equity. All we ask is that you don't trash us publicly when we give you this pile of money or potential future lottery tickets. And the other person might say, you know what? Screw you. I'm going to write a tell-all book, which they probably signed an NDA on the way in that they can't do that. But this is kind of like a confirmation at the end. Hey, you signed an NDA at the beginning to not trash us. We're not going to trash you. It's reciprocal. So therefore, everybody tends to be okay with it. What's the reason why this one, I think, caught people's attention is twofold. One, the never-ending drama that is OpenAI. Sam yes. being fired, rehired. Did they discover, you know, general intelligence, all this kind of stuff? And that they could claw back and take back that money.
Yes.
That is the part that's got people a little bit tweaked. What would be the reciprocal effect, Alex, if the company trashed you? So if the company trashed you, do you get more money? Do you get something? In this case, no. So this is like a little bit overbearing. If it's your equity and you earned it, they shouldn't be able to claw it back. But there does need to be some sort of, something has to occur. There has to be a cost to trashing the company or former boss if you agreed not to, right? And the company.
So my question is, there's things that exist in legal terms and paperwork that we all sign and most of us don't read. And then there's what's actually applied in the market. So if this sort of setup is relatively common in terms of people writing it down and signing it, how common is this actually to see put into practice? Because Sam Altman of OpenAI said, one, I didn't know this was happening. Two, we've never clawed back equity. Yeah. Vested equity is just that, vested. So to me, is this like a thing that was buried deep in the docs that no one even knew existed and therefore wasn't used? And therefore it's a PR issue? Or do some companies actually claw back vested equity, which to me doesn't seem right or fair?
I have never heard about vested equity being clawed back. The only exception would be fraud. So let's say you stole something, you misrepresented your revenue numbers, you, I don't know, physically attacked another employee. I mean, like really crazy criminal stuff. You know, like dark stuff. I could see them trying to wipe out your equity. Even if you did that in the, let's say somebody went crazy and literally beat up somebody at work. I mean, that's never happened, right? But let's say that happened. Somebody loses their mind. If you tried to claw back their equity and got into a legal battle over it, I don't think you'd win. Even in the case of a criminal assault charge, I don't think you'd be able to claw back their equity. So this is like more embarrassing and bad optics than it is reality, to answer your question.
Yes. I think also it was a bigger story because one of the people who left was on the safety and security side of things. And so people thought maybe they were being muzzled by this and they're, you know, it's the kind of Sam Altman, Emperor Palpatine meme type thing that he's behind the scenes pulling all the strings. In reality, I think there is some tension at OpenAI about how to approach safety. I know you have a perspective on that, but I do think that this equity issue is going to get sorted and hopefully goes away, because I think we should have robust, healthy debate and not kind of people worried about losing their meal ticket, essentially. Because I don't know if you've heard this, Jason, but OpenAI is worth a couple of dollars. So your equity does matter there.
Yeah, people have been selling their equity in this nonprofit / for-profit hybrid. We can get into that in a bit. At an $80, $90 billion valuation, I think Thrive Capital did a secondary and let people sell it. So this nonprofit, or theoretical nonprofit, is, you know, people have a lot at stake. If 20% of it's owned by the employees, let's say 30%, I mean, it's $25 million, $25 billion sitting out there, split up amongst, I think they have 500 or 1,000 employees.
It's not that many employees for the amount of value created, especially given how fast they're growing. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I'm just glad that this is being sorted out and we can put this particular episode of General Hospital behind us. But like all good sitcoms, we started somewhere, things happened, and we ended up exactly where we started off to begin with. So there we go, ladies and gentlemen. OpenAI part 495, I think.
Next week. tomorrow on General OpenAI Hospital.
We need some dramatic
Will
shots.
Sam.
I get Ilya, tell all. I get that mixed up with House, and House is the one with the doctor who like did too much drugs, but yeah. discovered cool things. And general, the other one's more like this relationshipy soap opera one, right?
I just remember in the 80s, my grandmother would watch these things. It was just like a fascinating thing to me that some people stayed home during the day and there was like some sort of television, broadcast television targeted to addict people who were staying home with their kids. And I think that's what soap operas were.
Well, that explains a lot about internet. Generation X and how they were raised and what they consumed. Now, yes. You know, we'll see a little bit later what happened to the TikTok generation. Yes. But I guess Gen X was the general hospital kids, if you will.
Listen, a strong sales team can make all the difference for a B2B startup. But if you're going to hire sharks, you need to let them hunt. And you can't slow them down with compliance hurdles like SOC 2. What is SOC 2? Well, any company that stores customer data in the cloud needs to be SOC 2 compliant. If you don't have your SOC 2 tight, your sales team can't close major deals. It's that simple. But thankfully, Vanta makes it really easy to get and renew your SOC 2 compliance. On average, Vanta customers are compliant in just 2 to 4 weeks. Without Vanta, it takes 3 to 5 months. Vanta can save you hundreds of hours of work and up to 85% on compliance costs. And Vanta does more than just SOC 2. They also automate up to 90% compliance for GDPR, HIPAA, and more. So here's your call to action. Stop slowing your sales team down and use Vanta. Get $1,000 off at vanta.com/twist. That's vanta.com/twist for $1,000 off your SOC 2.
I mean, it's my favorite trend on TikTok right now is they've summoned Gen X. And like Gen X is now coming out and being like, we're the... Somebody said, there was like all started on this woman with pink hair said, like, I think if we could all agree, Gen X is the worst generation ever. And then every Gen Xer was like, we're latchkey kids. We were free range kids. We were kicked out of our house.
Yes.
You know, we bled on the streets, yada, yada, yada. We don't care about, and like, and then the millennials got in between the millennials or whatever. And they're like,
No.
Don't summon Gen X.
Yeah. Leave Gen X alone.
They're crazy.
They are very independent and they have a lot of perspectives and they actually had some pretty good music to back it up.
Yes.
Leave them alone. That's my take. I the generation thing I think is useful as a fun, like, I don't know, rubric or heuristic or whatever, but don't get in between them because it is a lose battle.
Yes.
Now, what is not a lose battle though, is what's going on with OpenAI and their revenue in the wake of last week's announcement. Jason, I know you talked about this on, I think it was on All In and also on this show. I have played with GPT-4.0. Have you had a chance to actually dig into it?
Yeah, I've been playing with Omni. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I haven't been able to get the Omni companion where it's running on your desktop and you can show it your desktop working yet because I have a corporate account and I guess it's not released to the corporate accounts yet, which seems counterintuitive to me.
Okay.
But the product seems like it's getting better and better and they are working more on the user interface. And I think that's like the most interesting part of this is we are now in the phase where building the language model and indexing the world's content and consuming all this content and being able to regurgitate it and give you some interesting, sometimes delusional results. Okay, interesting, fun to play with. But when you start getting into, you know, being able to turn it on, talk to it, and have it understand what's going on around you, this gets really interesting. And I think consumers are starting to see the use case. And as you build that use case with consumers, then they're willing to pay for it. If you pay $240 a year for this as a business person, and you get but one good idea. Let's say you and I as writers, we summarize a podcast. We ask it for background on, you know, NVIDIA's history, and it gives us like reasonably good content, or we give it an old, you know, NVIDIA video and say, summarize this and timestamp it. Like that kind of stuff is worth $2,400. You would give a research assistant who gets paid $30 an hour. You know, that work. And so you and I being in editorial and journalism know like researchers get paid $30, fact checkers, maybe $40. And if it does that, man, that's pretty significant.
You will not churn.
And that's really the issue is will you cancel your subscription? Cause you're not getting a lot out of it. I subscribe to everything, Claude, Poe, this, and now I'm starting to look at it and saying, well, which ones do I actually need? Right. And that's, I think, the phase we're going into right now is, do I need this? Is it essential? Or can I use the free version? Because now it's free. When you do a Google search, it summarizes stuff at the top. And I think 3.5 is free without login. So,
yeah, but I mean, maybe it's just the inner nerd in my soul, but like if there's a new AI model, I must have it. Like I'm not going to sit back here and be like, well, you know, it'll come out in 6 months. Okay. Like Dune 2 came out. Yeah. I have a small child. I have to wait to see Dune 2 until it shows up on my TV. And now I'm going to watch it this weekend. Very excited. But with it's things incredible. That I can control, I am going to buy them immediately. So I have a personal OpenAI account that I pay for. And my dad loves it, actually. Yeah. So I got to tinker with this. The spoken word element of GPT-4 Omni, fantastic. Like,
it's unbelievable, yeah.
If you brought that 4 or 5 years ago and showed it to someone, they would think it's fake, it's impossible, there's no way. Yes. It is fantastic.
Explain very excited about this. Why this is better in your mind as a consumer than Siri.
I don't mean to be a mean and unkind person, but Siri is hot garbage. And it has not gotten better in... Okay, here's how long Siri has not been good. I was living in Chicago while I was going to university, and one of the co-founders of Siri came to Chicago, where he was from, and gave a talk about selling the company to Steve Jobs.
Right.
Since that point, I do not think Siri has gotten materially better. Whereas LLMs have been improving at a simply almost organic, exponential pace.
Yes.
And so to me, the ability to talk to something that can understand what I'm saying and converse with me means that I am one step closer to being able to talk to my computer and do things very quickly that can accelerate my overall process. And that's why I didn't put it in today's show, but Microsoft's new Copilot Plus PCs are once again drifting in that direction. I can see a world where GPT-4 Omni plus voice plus some stuff built into Windows, and suddenly your PC that you use can do a lot more. And hopefully our iPhones too. But that's why I'm excited about it, because it's better and it's getting better faster.
Yeah. And if I talked to Sam about this on All In, I think, the CB problem is the big problem with Siri and Alexa. You know, you're like, hey, Siri, give me driving instructions to get to this place. Oh, I just activated my Siri, or Alexa, do this, or okay, Google, do that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have to be like over. And then it does this thing. And then your kid says, oh, do this. Don't play this song. Or like you get interrupted and it just never works. And you're waiting 60 seconds for it to come back to you. If you have to wait more than 3 or 4 seconds, you could have typed it and you could have gotten the search result already. So that's what I benchmark it against. Is this more suffering and pain than typing the address into Waze, you know, or my Tesla's, you know, Google Maps? And it turns out... Most of the time, Siri is slower than me just typing it in.
Also, sometimes you'll be like, Siri, give me directions to my spouse's work. And it'll say, okay, playing Kenny G now on Apple Music. And you're like, great. I don't think that's quite what I had in mind.
No.
But a couple of data points on this. So TechCrunch had some news up about how big of an impact this new model is having on OpenAI. And the thing that really got me kind of going here was that they have seen net revenue on the mobile side, so ChatGPT mobile, rise from about $491,000 a day to about $900,000 a day. Now, we all know that OpenAI is a big company now. It's doing billions of dollars in run rate. But here is a dramatic increase in the amount of money consumers are paying from their own non-corporate accounts to use this stuff. And to me, that shows that what we are talking about is not technology that will work in 5 years. It's technology that people are willing to pay for now. And that to me is the mark of something that really does have, as we say in the startup world, PMF. It just does.
It's strong product market fit. And it's actually what we call deep in the industry market pull. So Andy Ratcliffe, co-founder of Benchmark and Wealthfront, who's been on this program a bunch of times, he talks about market pull. That's when the market wants something and they're calling you saying, I'll take six, right? You open up your bakery and then somebody shows up and is like, yeah, I need 100 baguettes. You're like, what for? It's like, well, I have a restaurant down the block. Boom, you got market pull. These baguettes are great. It reminds me of the iPhone. I skipped iPhone 14. I went from 13 to 15. Before that, I would buy iPhone 3, iPhone 3S, iPhone 4, iPhone 4S, iPhone 5, iPhone 5. I mean, I bought every single update. So I think this technology is so compelling and moving at such a fast pace. I agree with you. You must keep buying it and playing with it. I have set my action button on the iPhone 15, which is that like button above your volume that takes you directly into an app. When I press that, what it does is it takes me directly to ChatGPT.
Ah, look at that.
And the reason I did that was I really want to have this experience like her in the movie where I just talk and talk to it. And when I'm driving with my kids again, like they'll ask me a question about like
Yes. Okay. It's going to be okay, ChatGPT. It just told me they're experiencing heavy load.
So speaking of product pull right there, I mean, if they're saying, sorry, guys, we have too many people that want our stuff right now, there's no more baguettes for you.
Navigating the B2B maze can feel really tough, huh? You're trying to hit the mark with all those top tier executives. You want them to pay attention to your enterprise product. But where can you find all those big fish, the whales, the ones who call the shots and make the buying decisions for corporations, for startups, and everybody in between? Well, here's where LinkedIn Ads is going to solve that problem for you. And I've used this. It is one of my secret weapons. LinkedIn means business. Business equals LinkedIn in people's minds. When you're on LinkedIn, you're in the business mindset. So you're going to really be thinking about business products and services. You're open to those opportunities. And LinkedIn recently passed a billion users. 180 million of those billion are senior executives, 18%. But hey, we all know about the 1%. 10 million C-suite executives. That's your CFO, CTO, CIO. These are the people who are always looking for a new product or service to make their organization run better, but they are on LinkedIn. That's why LinkedIn's ad platform delivers 2 to 5 times greater return on investment compared to other social media platforms. So easy to understand why this is, because this is where all the business people are and they're in that business mindset. Super easy call to action. Make your B2B marketing everything it can be and get $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/thisweekinstartups to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/thisweekinstartups. No spaces, no dashes. Terms and conditions apply because they're giving you a hundy.
It's been great when I'm in the car with my kids. We're driving to Tahoe or something, got a bunch of time. They'll ask me a question about something and I'll be like, oh yeah, tell me the history of Ireland or tell me about this. And it's pretty fun, you know, to have that assistant there. And so, yeah, I mean, kudos to them. I think it's $1 million a day. It looks like App Figures is saying their revenue is getting to, and that doesn't even count the enterprise side, which we have enterprise ChatGPT at launch.
Yes.
So we pay for everybody. So now that you're paying for your personal, you're going to have a launch address and you'll also have it from the company.
I'm trying to actually make those two play nicely. Part of my day today was getting all my stuff turned on, set up and so forth. But I mean, again, I'll happily pay for it just because my dad uses my account, my personal, and just can't get enough of it. And he is not a tech guy. So that to me is another element of this works for folks who just want to do stuff and get things done. But here's my question that I don't have as good a visibility into as you, which is how well is the enterprise side of AI doing? Because when you think about every company in the last 18 months has been talking about adding AI or we've been doing AI for 10 years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To me, I can easily see it in my life that consumers cannot get enough of this stuff. And some companies like Launch, sure. But how well is the enterprise side of like this new AI technology that's being imbued into every piece of software? How is that performing? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag. Some people, you know, are just not going to use it. Like I remember when I started in IT in the late 80s, early 90s, some people at that time, boomers basically, had an assistant, like what we would call a secretary with a PC, and they had an office with no PC. Can you imagine going to work with no computer in your office? It's like, what did you do all day?
I think you just wrote things down on paper.
You wrote things on paper, you took phone calls, and you took meetings. Like, that's what an attorney did. And then typing was something that a secretary or the typing pool, literally there was a floor with just people who typed. And that was a career, typing.
Yeah.
And proofing was a career. A lot of the things that we like look at now are like, wait, I have Grammarly, and that makes my, I mean, it's incredible what Grammarly does. And you and I are writers. I don't know if you've ever had Grammarly give you a suggestion. You're like, yeah, it's pretty good, actually. Nicely done.
Today, for the first time, I used Grammarly for the first time in like 5 years, because again, setting up my computer for this show and stuff. And I was like, oh, actually, all right, fair enough. It's pretty good. Although it does not appreciate if you're speaking in like shorthand in a note stock for a podcast. Sometimes it likes to say things like that's terrible grammar. And I say, no, but still
it's a bullet point.
You know, I'm trying to be terse here, Grammarly.
Yes.
But I will say, going back to the consumer side of things, did you see the news that they have pulled one of the voices of the new GPT-4? Yeah, they pulled Sky, which is one of the women. And they said, this is not Scarlett Johansson's voice that we have deepfaked. Instead, it is a actress that we have used to create this voice imprint. But they had to say, it's not ScarJo. And so I presume that there was a call from someone's legal team saying, hey, we think you have stolen our voice. But they're working on that. But I got to say, I went through each of the different voice options and they're all pretty good.
Yeah. Speechify is a cool product I use that will follow you around the web and read web pages to you. So if, you know, sometimes, you know how it is, we're in front of computers all day. I just like to have something read to me, or I'll send it a PDF and it will read it to me when I'm on the treadmill or going for a walk or driving. And it's had this for a while, a voice that's presidential, they call it, clearly Barack Obama. And then they have one that's Gwyneth Paltrow. And I was like, holy cow. And I asked Gwyneth, like, did you approve this? She said, yeah, I did it with them like 4 years ago. So you can have Gwyneth Paltrow read you the Wall Street Journal or a Barack Obama-ish impersonator. But yeah, this will, I think on the enterprise side, it's a no-brainer when you're doing research. Like if you were to ask it, I don't know, make me a marketing plan, right? For a new podcast or write a press release about Alex joining This Week in Startups. If you've never done those tasks as an employee, it's going to start you on third base, basically. I'm not saying it's like the finished product, but if it's starting you on second and third base, hey, how do I plan an event for 100 people? What should I think about? And it's like location, ambiance, theme, AV. And you're like, oh, I didn't think about ambiance and theme, or gift bag. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of making everybody bionic right now. And what I want to be able to do is have multiplayer mode. And we don't have that yet. But imagine you and I sharing a space, right? Where we're talking to the AI together. And I think that's what Sax is doing with Glue AI is it's kind of like Slack, but the AI's in the room with you. So if you and I were working on show notes, and let's say we're doing something like the history of BlackBerry, we decide we're going to do a retrospective on that. We could be talking to it and say, hey, when was BlackBerry formed? And tell me about the funding and what were their initial products and how were they received? And it goes out to the web and gives us bullet points. And you and I are in a thread with the AI. Now you start to think about how valuable that is when the AI is on the Zoom call, the AI is in the Slack room or in Glue AI.
Yep.
That's where I think this is all headed, which is the AIs are coworkers, right?
Yes.
And they're going to seem like not very sophisticated coworkers at first, like maybe C-3PO to Luke Skywalker and Han Solo. And then all of a sudden they're going to seem like transcendent, where they're like telling us what to do, right? And I think we're on that journey.
I think it's going to be incremental, but quick. And so I think it's going to feel like we're going to look back and 5 years will have gone by and we'll have these amazing tools. But I bet you it's going to be kind of like a step function each time. But that's still really fast because we are doing really quick things here. And so I know there's worries about AI in a number of different ways, deepfakes in developing economies around elections and so forth. Lots of things to think about. But fundamentally, technology has found a new path to go faster now. And after we've all gotten a little bored of mobile, a little bored of new iPhones, I think it's great that there's something out there that is pushing the boundaries, making people a little scared, and also hopefully giving us the next thing like that can help us do a lot more faster, because we don't have enough people. So more productivity is going to help a lot.
Yeah. I mean, doing more with less is going to be the theme. I think if you look at to make this brass tacks, you know, Uber hasn't added employees. Like I think their net new employees is flat for 3 years. So, you know, people leave, people get hired, but just net, I think it's 3 years flat. I think Airbnb is very similar, but those companies are growing at 20 or 30% revenue. So if your revenue is going up 20, 30% year over year and your headcount stays the same, how is that efficiency happening? Well, software businesses should be efficient, but I think a big part of it is AI and globalization. And that means these companies are going to be able to do more with less, which means what happens to everybody else? You got to go start more companies. You got to go solve more problems in the world. And God knows there's a ton of problems in the world to be solved. Okay, cloud computing has revolutionized startups over the past decade. You know that. But the reality is, hey, a fully cloud-based solution is not right for every startup. Sometimes a hybrid solution is your answer. Like if you're working with sensitive data that can't be trusted to the cloud, or if you need to connect to multiple cloud providers at once, or maybe you just want a much more cost-effective solution. In that case, you need to check out Equinix. Equinix Metal will give you direct access to physical servers, but you still get all the benefits of the cloud. So no need to rack and stack your own servers. No, Equinix provides on-demand infrastructure in over 25 major cities. And here's the best part. They have an amazing startup program for you. The Equinix Startup Program offers personalized consultations and guidance from the Equinix team. And of course, you'll get up to $100,000 in startup credits. So here's what I want you to do. Head to equinixstartups.com to apply, And when you apply, James from Equinix is going to reach out to you directly. That's equinixstartups.com to apply. EQUINIX startups.com.
I could come up with quite a list right now of things that are keeping me up at night. But the good news is that people are working on them and they are paying themselves as they do this. And this means I get to bring up my favorite topic, which is how much should founders pay themselves, Jason? We've never answered this question once in the history of people talking about startups. So let's talk about some data from Pilot, who collected a bunch of different bits of data from founders in different geographies and different fundraising tiers, you might say, to bucket companies so we can see a little bit better. And I pulled a bunch of the data for us here. I'm curious which of the numbers that we have in front of us sticks out to you the most as the most either insane or the most kind of like that feels right to you.
Got it. Yeah. So Pilot's a great accounting partner for a lot of our startups. And so they actually have data. So this is in this sort of zone where like Carta or AngelList release information in aggregate. And it generally is pretty accurate. It's not the whole picture. It's a subset, but this does look to me to be accurate because when founders ask me this, after we raise their seed round, what we say to them is you should take the least amount of money possible to live without fear, you know, comfortably, so that as much money goes into the startup and the product and everything as possible, right? Mm-hmm. If you want max revenue with the least downside, you go work for corporate America and they pay you, you know, as much as possible and you leave and you're a free agent. But when you're an owner, it's like owning the NBA team versus playing for the NBA team. One, you're trying to optimize for salary. One, you're trying to optimize for the value of the enterprise. So if you are optimizing for the value of the enterprise and you raise $1 million, well, you don't want to pay yourself 500K. You want to pay yourself, you know, a 5 or 10K a month draw. That's what I typically see at startups. In the first couple of years, they pay themselves 5, 10K a month, which equals 60 to 120K. Looking at this data, it turns out I'm exactly right. Startups, 100K to a million, 90K, max 600K. That 600K is like some weird abomination. Like nobody should be. Yeah.
It's a fat finger. And someone, when they were filling in the survey information, made a mistake. That's my take of that number. Because
yeah,
if you raised 100K and you're paying yourself a $600,000 per year salary, you're going to have money for like 20 minutes, I think.
Yeah. It doesn't pencil out. So, and then you look at the next one, 1 million to 2.9 million raised, median founder salary, $125,000. And that seems right to me. In your startup, you should probably be like, I don't know, the 10th most expensive person as the founder. The sales executives, your all-star developers, your like savant product designer, UX wizard, like they should all be getting paid 200K or 150K or 250K. You know, if you're a $5 million startup, but you're the thing that this doesn't take into account is also globalization and like hiring people offshore or work from home people, remote people, which I think is the bigger story here. Founders, generally are founders in Silicon Valley, at least generally, half of them don't have kids yet and they're not married and they don't have mortgages. So their burn rate is low.
Yes.
Now, once you have two kids, private school, a mortgage, you know, maybe you got a spouse or not, you know, now your nut might be 30K a month, 20K a month. And so an exception is generally made in those cases when somebody goes to raise money. If that person isn't well-to-do and they've already made their money, you know, VCs might be like, okay, we know going into this that this person needs to get paid 400K a year just to cover their nut. And it seems crazy, but those founders tend to be more seasoned. They raise more money. They have an easier time getting to profitability. The sweet spot for founders actually is like 35 to 55 years old. Everybody thinks it's young people. It turns out like success rates are much higher in that group and much lower in the other group. We just remember the Zuckerbergs and the Gates.
It makes for better movies if you have someone who drops out of Stanford or pick another one of the schools. But what's interesting to me about this data is that it doesn't actually go up for a long time. So for startups that raise 1 to 2.9, 125K median, 3 to 5 million, 124K median. And then for startups that raise 5 to 10, 150. So really, it stays flat for a long time. Although once you raise over 10, it does go up to 194, according to Pilot. But really, it plateaus and stays. It's less elastic than I expected it to be.
And this becomes a board decision when you get to those levels. Once you've raised over 3, 4, 5 million, you start to have a board. The board then manages compensation. When you're in year 4, 5, 6, 7, what you want to do as a board, and this is a question that wasn't asked or isn't taken into account here, is what should you do after the founders are fully vested? It's year five, company's making $5, $10 million in revenue.
Yep.
What you want to do is tie their revenue to the performance of the company. So everybody's aligned, which is what Elon did with his pay package famously, and then had it taken away. And now they're trying to restate it, which is, hey, if the stock price goes up, you hit this milestone. Dara from Uber has a similar thing. Like when it broke yeah. 100 billion, he got some great, you know, slug of equity. It's kind of hard to fake that. It's hard to fake your public market valuation because the people who are buying that are the sharpest pencils in the class, right? They yes. understand like the reality of this business. So what you really want to do is as a board, make sure that you understand what the person's personal financial situation is, and then have it make it so they're not distracted. I'm always in, you know, when we yeah. get asked for money, hey, can I get a raise? You know, the conversation, or can I sell secondary? The number one goal is to keep the founder focused, and the stress of running a business is enough. They don't need to have mortgage stress or private equity, private education stress, or other stressors in their lives. Take that out so that they can just, you know, and then if you're starting a company or you're a young person, lower your burn rate. Like literally, if you've got a BMW payment and you got like a 3-bedroom, get a studio, you know, go public transport or, you know, get a used Prius for 10K, lower your burn so that you don't have to worry and be a slave to this nut that you're chasing every month.
Also, the thing people forget is that once you have a lower burn rate and you have more money saved, you have a bigger middle finger to give to anybody you don't want to work for, work with, listen to. Like, yeah. I mean, it is the hack around the annoying bits of capitalism. So yeah, keeping your burn rate low is fantastic. Although if you say private school one more time, I'm going to start having nightmares on the show because I recently learned how much money you can spend on kindergarten in first grade. And it's about as much as I paid to go to university.
It's kind of crazy. Yes. This, I'm a product of the public school system. And then I went to Boys Catholic yeah. High School for like $2K a year in the 80s. And they gave a discount of like $500 less for each one student. So I think my older brother was 2000, I was 1500, and my little brother yeah. was like 500 or 750. Yep. They really worked with you, the Catholic school system. But yeah, it gets quite expensive if you go that route. And if you have multiple kids, it can,
no, man.
Yeah, it can get crazy.
I think of it this way. I already pay property tax. Therefore I should get, they should get public school down the street. It's free.
And well, it's free. And then this is why I think, not to make this a political show, but you and I have political things. So we don't want to not talk about them. I think the voucher system and creating competition for education is just a great idea. If you're paying taxes into this pool mm-hmm. and the public school in your district isn't very good and you can get 14K, because I think the average is like 14,000 is what we spend in the United yeah. States, 15,000. I mean, some cities might be 20, and then some places in the South, it might be 10, like lower cost of buildings and salaries. But why not give that to parents? And they're like, oh, because then it's going to crush the public school system. It's like, well, maybe they need some competition if they're not doing so well.
As long as there's similar accreditation standards across charter schools and normal traditional public schools, I'm sympathetic to that. But to me, it comes down to what the implementation of it, because as I think you and I both know, when it comes to large, expensive government programs, if you don't get the details right, you can create a bigger mess. But I do think that I think the Providence schools are so bad the state took over. So a little competition wouldn't hurt, I don't think. I'm here for it.
I'm here for it too. All right, let's keep moving.
All right, so I grabbed a cybersecurity deal. Jason, do you know CyberArk or Venafi, just offhand?
I do not. Tell me.
Good. Because I had to like look these companies up. The reason why I put this into the show notes, one, it's a $1.5 billion deal. Essentially, CyberArk is buying Venafi from Thoma Bravo, so private equity. But the thing is, I was going through all the releases. The company's doing about $150 million ARR, which means that this is a 10x ARR deal. And that means it's a double digit ARR multiple. And founders used to get those for breathing back in 2021. Now, as we've seen, it's much harder to get and secure this, especially at scale.
Yeah.
And so I was curious, why is this company exiting for this dollar amount? And I did some parsing. So here's my hypothesis. One, nearly 100% recurring revenue. So this is a serious software business. This is not services. This is not crap. They're kind of pretending it's AR. It's real.
Quality revenue.
Quality revenue. And then also a business that isn't too expensive, because they said that it's going to be margin accretive on a non-GAAP basis kind of from the get-go. So it's not a trash fire of red ink. And then also it adds 10 billion or 20% to the new parent company's TAM in their view. So future growth.
Yeah. In these situations, the acquirer has a thesis. They have a plan, and we don't know what their plan is. But let's say when CyberArk buys this, what they may have done is looked at Vanafi's client list. They look at their client list. The overlap's 20%. It's an 80% that they already have their, you know, sales team going out to lunch with and taking to playoff games and whatever. And when you introduce this new product, they've penciled out, oh, well, we can triple the revenue. Therefore, we can, quote unquote, overpay for this. Yes. So when YouTube was bought by Google, they penciled it out and they're like, we already have servers. Like, we're going to save all this money on server infrastructure. We got global servers. We can run YouTube to every country. We've already done that. We've got servers and teams in Korea and Japan and Australia and all over the place. When you buy a company, if you have a way to monetize it at a higher scale quicker than the original company, you can pay 10x, 20x. It doesn't matter. It's funny money, because you'll just, boom, instantly put them through your distribution system. And distribution really matters. We've seen this when like Slack got bought by Salesforce. Now there's like, they took the two lists of, here's people who buy Salesforce, here's people who buy Slack. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of people who didn't overlap. Those are potential customers. And the integration with Salesforce and Slack theoretically could get really tight. I don't think it did. But anyway, that's typically what happens here, is the acquirer has some thesis, like Facebook buying Instagram. Okay, you cross-post your post from Facebook, from Instagram to Facebook. All these old people on Facebook who don't know what Instagram is, now go open an Instagram account.
Okay, but I want to go back, because you described 10x as part of the funny money bracket. I mean, Jason, 10x ARR was conservative like 18, 24 months ago, but now you're describing that as pretty expensive. Am I reading your comments there correctly, that 10x is almost like an aspirational, like ARR exit multiple for technology companies of scale? Because that's what it sounds like to me.
I think we're going to see the multiples in SaaS go back up. I think we'll see that. I think we bottomed out, and, you know, because there was a great SaaS consolidation that occurred, where, you know, during the down market of 2022 into 2023, when the market collapsed, two things happened. One, headcount went down. Remember all those layoffs? Mm-hmm. Well, if you lay off 30% of your team, or like, you know, there's 30,000 less people or 40,000 less people working at Microsoft, Facebook, Uber, Airbnb, those people don't need Grammarly. Those people don't need Salesforce. They don't need, they're not in Slack anymore. So you have this incredible headwind that all of the SaaS companies felt at the same time. Then some CFO says, you know what? Boss wants to save some money. We've got 400 SaaS products. It's going to be 200.
Yep.
And then they just go to everybody, can you do this feature in this product? And so something like Coda or Notion, you know, if you were using, let's say, Asana, nothing wrong with Asana, great product. But you can kind of do that in Notion or Coda. So then the boss says, can we do that in Coda or Notion project management or to-do list or whatever? Great. We don't need the full strength version of Asana. We'll just go with that. Or vice versa. Asana does something that, you know, some other product does. And so that's where you're seeing a lot of these SaaS products add adjacencies.
Yep.
And they want to be the last SaaS standing.
I think that's dead on. And actually, when you go back and read this particular acquisition, this Vanafi deal, they said that it's going to help them create a unified platform for machine identity security at enterprise scale. But exactly that. And also Bessemer, a venture firm that I'm sure everyone listening to this is familiar with, in the cybersecurity space, which is what we're talking about in this deal, said that the growing trend is major players are increasingly turning to product-only acquisitions to build platforms. And so everyone's trying to get a little bit broader, a little bit deeper, and so that we don't get bumped off as a point solution when the CFO says, hey, we are going from 400 to 200. And so it's almost like SaaS musical chairs leading to consolidation. That's great. I'm sad that we're not seeing more startups go from zero to IPO, because that's what I really want to see. But at least we're getting some deals out of it. We're learning from it. And so that's kind of why I wanted to talk about this. I think cybersecurity is especially ripe for consolidation. So I bet you, I don't know, lunch, that we're going to have two, three, four more of these in the next couple of quarters.
Yeah, I think Palo Alto Networks has a lot of acquisitions. A lot of these, like what I'll call single and doubles, you might call them tuck-in acquisitions, under $1 billion in revenue, way under Lena Khan's radar. She's got bigger fish to fry. And frankly, you know, like, it's kind of boring and you're not going to get any headlines going after this Israeli cyber company that's trying to make people safe. And it's a little $1 billion acquisition, $500 million. So who cares? We got Microsoft, Google, we got scary people who are impacting the world in their mind that need to be controlled and reined in. Breaking news coming in about the Scarlett Johansson, her voice. Maybe you could read this for us, Alex. Breaking news. We have a breaking news story here. This is a first for Alex's co-hosting here. It's in the Slack room. You can pull it up. Breaking news from ScarJo.
Breaking news from ScarJo. So, quote, last September, I received an offer from Sam Altman, who wanted to hire me to voice the current ChatGPT 4.0 system. He told me that he felt that by my voicing the system, I could bridge the gap between tech companies and creatives and help consumers to feel comfortable with the seismic shift concerning humans and AI. He said he felt that my voice would be comforting to people. After much consideration and for personal reasons, I declined the offer, which means that ScarJo has plenty of money because I'm sure OpenAI was showing up with the dump truck money. 9 months later, she goes on, my friends, family, and the general public all noted how much the newest system named Sky sounded like me. When I heard the release demo, I was shocked, angered, and in disbelief that Mr. Altman would pursue a voice that sounded so eerily similar to mine that my closest friends and news outlets could not tell the difference. Mr. Altman even insinuated that the similarity was intentional, tweeting a single word, quote, her, a reference to the film in which I voiced a chat system, Samantha, who forms an intimate relationship with a human. Briefly, 2 days before the 4.0 demo was released, Mr. Altman contacted my agent, asking me to reconsider. Before we could connect, the system was out there. Then, she says, hired legal counsel, letters written to Altman, and then they've taken down the Sky voice, as we mentioned earlier. Okay, Jason, I have views about this. You can be a scamp, you can be a rogue, you can skirt the rules when you are small, not famous, and not rich as hell as OpenAI is. What were they thinking? This, of course, they were going to get in trouble for this.
I mean, we keep having these instances occur. And you remember the rumors of why Sam was fired the first time were, and we talked to him about this candidly on All In, were like, hey, this deal making, right? Like, this, he's a consummate deal maker. I've known Sam for 20 years. He is a great deal maker. He talked Elon into co-founding OpenAI and putting like $50 million in, right? Yes. Like, and then he was in the Middle East, not raising $7 trillion. That was like a mistake by the press. They probably were looking at the TAM, the total addressable market of chips, whatever, or the future projections of how many we sold. And they thought he was raising $7 trillion. But
it's still a lot of money. He wasn't going there for...
Yeah, he's probably raising a billion or two, right? To make chips or whatever, FOVs and whatever. Putting all that aside, you know, if you're a great deal maker, sometimes you can maybe, what's the word? Scarface would say, get a little high on your own supply kind of situation. Yes. And this feels like that, which is like, okay, she doesn't want to say yes. She doesn't want what I would think is $25 million. I'm guessing they offered her whatever she got for Black Widow times two. And I remember ScarJo had to sue Disney to get her Black Widow's money because they didn't release it during pandemic. I think they went direct to video. There
was that window of release and the royalties. Yeah. If you ever want to figure out more about that, just look up Hollywood accounting, which I believe is a fancy word for fraud. But they like to play with the numbers so that way they don't have to pay out a lot of stuff. But anyways, he got a little high on his own supply here.
Why do this is what I would be thinking. If she doesn't want her likeness and she made that, or she wanted a higher price and you weren't willing to pay for it, why would you poke the bear? She is a high profile person.
Yeah.
And this is just a bad look to be leveraging a person's celebrity, making them an offer, calling them 2 days before, trying to get the offer done, And then being like, YOLO, you didn't do it. We'll have AI make a fake voice that's similar to her. I say not cool. Not cool, yeah. Sam. You should just respect people's... there's a term, there's a legal term for this, which is a person's like right to their personality.
Mm.
And a lot of us in podcasting who have become a little higher profile have to deal with this, which is somebody will take a clip of me saying something. This happened 2 or 3 times.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go run an ad. So I say something nice about a startup and then they will take it and then do a YouTube ad on it. And I'm like, hey, you can't do that without my permission. And they're like, but you said it publicly. I'm like, I said in the context of my show, you're using me for this other reason. That's not allowed. And the way she phrased this was very specific. The confusion of the public is a test for this specific issue. When the public is confused, then you have a case. The reason she said, my family and friends all told me congratulations on this deal, is she's setting up the lawsuit. She's going to want now a settlement, and a settlement they will pay her. I am certain.
Well, I mean, all they have to do is call 1-800-SATYA-NADELLA and make sure that the check clears. But I mean, just an unnecessary mistake. And this goes back to your earlier, I mean, joke about them being General Hospital, this never-ending soap opera. I mean, here is a second rake in the face for a company that didn't need to step on any rakes. They already have money and technology and momentum, and they're kicking Alphabet's butt right now, for as far as I can tell. And they can't stop stepping on rakes. And it's beginning to make it seem like, I'm trying to find a way to phrase this, Jason, without blowing up the internet, but like maybe the board had a couple of reasonable points when they were a little peevish with Mr. Altman earlier. I'm not saying he should have been fired from the company entirely, but I mean, this is not a great look for someone who should know better, because Sam's not 21. He's been around the block. He's run things before.
Absolutely.
And the fact that he called her 2 days before, I think, goes to show that there was some guilty conscience pricklings going on. And that should have been enough to pull the plug on just one of the voice models. They didn't even need this. They had like 5 others.
Yeah. It's called the right of publicity. And you saw this come up with, I brought it up with ads and stuff like that. But this happened with George Carlin's estate suing because somebody made a comedy special with George Carlin. You can't just do this stuff, right? And the people making deep fakes, I don't want to even bring up Taylor Swift deep fakes because they're really disgusting. And, it's they're sexual in nature. And so it's super abhorrent. There's like 2 levels there. But the right of publicity is basically, I'm allowed to be Jason Calacanis or Taylor Swift or Alex Wilhelm. You could be who you are and not be used by other people in commerce. And part of the test is, again, is the public confused? And here, I think the public is confused.
But it's just, it's such a waste. But I mean, like think about it. We were talking 10, 15 minutes ago about how cool this technology is, how fast it's moving, how we're excited about it. Where is it going to go next? What software is going to be baked into? How is it going to change our life? How are we going to work on it together? And then we have to talk about Scarlett Johansson and her likeness and royalties and that. I mean, I don't want to, but we have to because it matters. But it just. He needs Sam may need a new best friend to sit him down every like 10 days and be like, that's stupid. Don't do that. Everyone needs that person in their life. I have it. I presume you do, Jason.
I have it. I am it for a number of friends where they just say, hey, am I crazy? And I'm like,
yes. Yeah. Yes. This time don't do that. Yeah. Ask the group chat, Sam.
Go to your group chat. Hey, should I do this? And he's like, no. One wonders if this is an explicit strategy like Trump to stay in the media and then sell subscriptions. So maybe like creating all this drama and chaos keeps you as part of the cycle. I don't know.
You know what they said in their presentation the other week, OpenAI, that 100 million people use ChatGPT. They are the conversation already. I don't think they need any help. It's like if Metallica put out like a new like water brand, they don't need that to sell at a stadium. Just show up, play guitar, have some fun and go away. In this case, make an AI model, sell it to me. Huzzah. Don't get Scarlett Johansson. Don't turn the public sentiment against you for no reason when consumers are paying part of your bills. Maybe is the best way to put it.
I was just talking to Huberman about this because he has people using him talking about different nutrients or whatever in their ads. So he'll talk about, hey, you know, you should this, you know, compound, whatever is good for this reason, help you sleep, help you build muscle mass, whatever. They make an ad, they put him in it. And he's constantly having to sue these people who are making, you know, different vitamins and pharmaceuticals of like, you can't use me in your ad. Just because I talked about vitamin D doesn't mean I'm a spokesperson for vitamin D. And you know what? He wins. And he's winning every time. So
of course he's winning every time. I just hope it's enough money to matter.
For young people, don't do this. Like, I think some people don't understand the law. You're not allowed to use other people to make money without their permission, full stop, whether it's authors, whether it's Disney,
whether
it's Taylor Swift.
Trying to get us into the OpenAI AI training data, fair use? Because I feel like you're bringing us slowly over to that part of the conversation.
I just think there's a general lack of respect in our industry for content. And, you know, Sam, when he was on All In, talked about how music, they didn't want to do any music. I don't know if you heard that conversation, but he was very delicate around music and didn't feel it was fair. I can tell you what that is. In our industry, it's known, don't poke the music bear. They will come down on you. Remember Peloton was using their music? Like, will try to get an injunction against you to stop your product from being sold in the market. They're hardcore. They're not like content sites or newspapers, which have traditionally been like, oh, I don't know if we should do a lawsuit, although the New York Times is doing it. They finally stood up.
UMG and Sony will come and kick your door down and take your money.
Absolutely. And I've seen it up close and personal with startups we have, where like somebody uses music, you know, YouTube did it, other people, you know, they'll have music in their system and they're like, oh yeah, you're using music. Here's your lawsuit and here's your settlement. And you're like, ah, I think I'll do the lawsuit. They're like, great. Go look up the Napster lawsuit. We'll be here for 7 years.
Speaking of Metallica, I didn't think Napster and Metallica were going to come up on the show today, but hey, here we are. Speaking about things that are a blast from the past, though, I want to talk just for a second about what's going on with crypto venture capital, because it's coming back and it's not super crazy. Yeah. So the data from PitchBook indicates that $2.4 billion was invested into crypto companies in the first quarter of this year. And that's up from a Crunchbase data point of $1.2 billion Q4 of last year. So a pretty quick ascent. And Coinbase is doing good. Regulatory clarity is coming around. Are we due for another crypto bull cycle? I don't know, but I never write them off, Jason, because I've been around long enough to not make that mistake.
I feel like there's Bitcoin and everything else. So if we just talk, there's like Bitcoin in the exchanges and there's everything else. Bitcoin, store of value. It's a unique one of one technology in the world that nobody owns and that has, you know, survived the test of time. So if we put Bitcoin in its own little bucket, obviously, if you're living in Venezuela or you're trying to get money out of China or Russia, or you're doing some illegal activity or gray market activity, it's a wonderful thing to be able to store it, transfer it, put it on a thumb drive. It's magical. Then there's like every other use case, and the exchanges help you trade Bitcoin. Great. ETFs, yada, yada. There's a business there. Everything else, you know, I'm struggling to find the use case where having something on a blockchain or NFTs or whatever actually provide enough value that it's worth the technical hurdles, right? So everybody keeps coming up with, I guess this Farcaster is like the Twitter, decentralized Twitter that they're trying to build.
Is that what Jack is working on?
No, that was Blue Sky. And then he resigned from Blue Sky. But there's another guy. Something, yeah. And then there's Farcaster. I forgot the guy's name, but he does a podcast and he's pretty smart cat. And like Farcaster, I should have him on the program at some point.
Yeah.
It's trying to make like the distributed version of Twitter that nobody can ever, you know, take down. Right. And is, you know, censor resistant, whatever. I don't know that that's enough of a use case for people to do all these technical hard things to sign on and for it to hit scale. Like, in other words, the value of decentralization for money, if you're a money launderer or you're trying to, you know, fight against your currency being devalued, whatever it happens to be, like that's a really great use case and it's worth the squeeze. Call it Uber or book an Airbnb. Like, everybody told me Airbnb and Uber were going to be disintermediated by crypto.
Huh. Yeah. People said I was going to tokenize my house. Turns out I haven't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, tokenizing your house is an interesting one. There is like this ability to take a home and then sell the shares in the home, right? And have it be a way for people to play the real estate market. And I think that's a thing. And
isn't that just a real estate investment trust, aka REIT, aka a thing we've already invented?
Well, yes. And that requires a bunch of paperwork, just like a venture fund requires a bunch of paperwork, et cetera. You know, in venture, at some point, it'll be legal to create a venture fund that's tokenized. And I will do it when it's legal and it's buttoned up. Imagine I raised $100 million from 100,000 people, $1,000 each, whatever it is, 10,000 people, 10,000 each. Do your back of the envelope math. And then let's say that $100 million doubled in value. And you said, well, you know, I put 10K into that and I double my money. I have 20K right now. I'm going to sell my 10K to somebody else who appreciates the assets in that fund. And then I covered my bases and I'm free rolling on the other 10K. That would be amazing. Do you know how hard that is to do in venture? It's impossible. Like people selling secondary in a fund. Oh, it's so hard. And I don't, have you been following this DXYZ? I just had the founder. DXYZ fund stock.
This is the Destiny Tech. Oh, yes. This is the thing that owns stakes that it's not supposed to have in private companies that weren't approved to be sold as secondaries.
Yeah.
In some cases. And I talked to him about that issue. And
it's cool, you know, this, to be clear. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, this just shows how much the public wants to participate in the private market. So,
yes,
I do think like an idea like this that was on a blockchain would be fine with me if it's regulated and people aren't going to get scammed. The problem, of course, 99% of these things are scams, grifts, or incompetence, or some combination of those.
Yes. And sometimes they're fun. Like no one has more fun than the crypto kids. They invent a new meme token. Like there's Bonk now, which is like a Shiba Inu offshoot on Solana. Okay. They're having more fun than I'm having. I pay property tax. I don't know. But I will say, though, when you talk about tokenizing a venture capital fund, I can totally see a use case for that. But it's still an inherently financial use case of the blockchain. And that, to me, is the limit around my interest in it. Because whenever I pull up a crypto-focused game, for example, it's always about NFTs and trading. And no offense to the crypto folks out there, but that's not what I want. That said, though, you and I, our perspectives, VCs are showing up and putting more money into this stuff again. And so I'm curious to see what comes out of this next wave, because we haven't seen a new innovation like NFTs a couple cycles ago, ICOs a couple cycles before that. So I'm curious what will be the thing that makes the souffle rise yet again. And frankly,
I mean, Bitcoin is over 70,000 as we speak. It's up 6% today. So
what the hell is crypto does that?
And Bitcoin's been around for 15 years and hasn't been hacked. It's really one of the most resilient things humanity's built. Like it feels like the Great Wall of China to me. Like, are we all going to die in a pandemic? And then like Bitcoin is still running and like some alien species comes here 1,000 years from now and they're like, yeah, they're all gone, but hey, their Bitcoin servers are still running. And we have some archaeological evidence that humans were smart. They created this token.
Okay. So do you use Fidelity, Vanguard, or any of those kind of equivalent online brokerage services?
Sure.
Sure. I know that all of my money, which is in those services, is at risk to one EMP, right? Like if you take out the computers, all my money goes away. This is the one thing that gold bugs do have right. But I think at the same time, if you take out all the technology and the servers and stuff, Bitcoin also grinds to a halt. And so to me, it is, I think, as you said, a store of value. I think it has shown the test of time because we're still talking about it. But it does have the same risks that I think other modern forms of money and value have to it. And it hasn't solved that because if you show up in the future, Wild West 2.0, when there's no water left with a USB stick with some Bitcoin on it, you're not going to get a drink, I don't think.
Going back to politics, I think if you want to win the presidential election, if you come out and say, as part of becoming president, I am going to solve the regulatory framework, presidential order, straight down to the SEC, and we're going to fix this mess, and Americans will be able to trade in crypto, and we're going to be the leaders of crypto in the world, you would get, you know, low single digit percentage of these lunatics, young people who love DraftKings and sports betting, stonks, Robinhood, and crypto.
Sure.
And you say, listen, it's your money. You want to bet it on the Knicks? You want to bet it on Bitcoin or an ICO? Or you want to, you know, bet it on GameStop? It's your money. You're free to do it. And here's like a sophisticated test. You know, take this test, learn about diversification and scams, protect yourself, and then have at it. I think that wins you a couple of points in the election. And I think Trump's going to do that, by the way.
The election, right? Because in the U.S., it's always 48-52. So this week, the House is going to take up the Financial Innovation and Technology for the 21st Century Act, or what they're calling FIT 21, bipartisan, endorsed by the Blockchain Association. Generally a well-received thing. And one thing that it does, according to a House summary, is participants will have a clear process to determine which digital asset transactions are subject to the SEC's jurisdiction and so forth. And so essentially, they're trying to solve what you're saying. And I think the Democrats are coming around a little bit on this. If you, I've been watching the tea leaves in the last 10, 14 days. I think this is turning around. And what I think that means is that the crypto long-term believers, your Brian Armstrongs, et cetera, are going to get most of what they want, which means that the U.S. is going to stay pretty much, I think, the global epicenter for crypto talent and so forth, apart from tax havens and so forth out there. But
I mean, you know, Singapore and other places were really, you know, trying in Dubai, other, you know, the Zerg, whatever that was, and Switzerland was trying to.
Yeah.
Remember that? Like they were going to be the place. I think Montana or Wyoming were doing DAOs. And I thought the DAO, I don't know. Did you follow the DAO thing?
Decentralized autonomous organizations.
Yeah. What did you think of that?
Jason, I was in Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. And I have been a patrol leader. I have been a senior patrol leader. Uh-huh. I have herded the cats. Uh-huh. And that's why I was a little skeptical of DAOs.
Yeah.
I love the idea. I love pure democracy. I love people working together. I love federating out power to the folks. But a Discord group does not a democracy make. And so to me, like the technology was never there to actually underpin the aspirations.
Yep.
And so it struck me as like modern day utopian.
Yeah, sure. Utopian.
Sure. English. I speak it. Utopian yes. thinking.
Yeah.
That was great. And it never really took off. And I don't think we've seen a DAO apart from maybe MakerDAO that has actually stayed around long enough to have this sort of impact people hoped that they were going to have. So cool. But you know, not exactly.
It kind of turns into Lord of the Flies awfully quick, doesn't it? I think is your point. Boy Scouts and Lord of the Flies are like either end of the spectrum, right? You got like the Navy SEALs, Boy Scouts, and then Lord of the Flies. I was a scout as well.
Lord of the Flies and Boy Scouts are much closer together than you're thinking. It's feral children.
Exactly. it gets a little crazy out there.
I know we have to go, but like, I'll just say this. Pay attention to the crypto regulatory scene this week, everybody. There could be some important votes that could determine where venture capital flows, where founders flow, and where projects are built. So if you care about that, it's a big week.
And then for market pull, we talked about, you know, two really great examples of market pull in our industry historically for founders who just want to study that. And one of the things, Alex, I'm really glad you're here, is you can, as a journalist and an editor-in-chief of all these publications over time that are at large, all these titles you had, you can start looking at the advice for founders and startups and maybe helping me tease out some of those topics for the audience. Like market pull comes up all the time. How do you know you have it? Like Stripe and Twitter were like two of the, it's canonical, I guess the word for that, like examples of market pull that we've ever seen in history. Those things really drove, you know, people who were like, I need some way to process payments that's cheap and fast and better. Yeah. And it was like, oh, have you not tried Stripe? And I was like, wait, what is that? And they just, boom, people sign up and start using it. You don't have to have a salesperson get on a call. And then with Twitter, it was like, do you want to talk to the world in real time from the sporting event or from your, you know, whatever, you know? And here's your publishing platform.
How good of examples those are. Actually, I would go back pre-Stripe and talk about Square, back when it was called Square.
Yes.
I recall when they put out the very first little reader you could plug into the bottom of your iPhone.
Yep.
3G, I think, back in the day.
Yeah.
I got one of those. I had no use for it whatsoever. I just wanted one because I knew it unlocked a thing, which was commerce, essentially.
Yes.
And I also will never forget the first time I figured out what Twitter was for. I used a client called Twirl back in the day, like 2009, 2008. And I'm like, wait a minute, I can just say as much as I want and other people have to listen to me. Instant, just full-on addict, haven't stopped since. I will be on Twitter when the universe ends, or X, or whatever.
Well, and you're also, again, back to the, you know, your political framing, you're a free speech absolutist. Yes, you're based on my watching you on social media over the years?
So free speech in terms of government control, absolutely a free speech absolutist. I think we should be allowed to say fuck on television. I do not want the government saying what I can and cannot say. At the same time, I do think the market will respond to certain speech. And I think people conflate the two. But when it comes to regulation, I'm about as close to a free speech absolutist as you can get. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so weird. Like our generation, because I think you're kind of on the tail end of Gen X. You consider yourself a tail end of Gen X or like
Don't shoot me, but I'm square in the middle of millennials.
Okay. Because you come across, you present as a Gen Xer.
It's the hair.
I think you, did you have Gen X mentorship when you were growing up? Like, were you around Gen Xers?
Yeah.
So I think that's the thing with some of the millennials is they kind of hung out with us because we were the older kids, like in high school, whatever. So if you had a Gen X influence on you, you're like, you know what? If a bunch of idiots want to prove to us they're racists by, you know, putting on bed sheets and pretending they're part of the Ku Klux Klan and march down Main Street, great. Now we know who these idiots are and they've proven it to the world. I'm fine with like Kanye West going on Twitter, saying crazy stuff and then getting suspended because you know what? Now we know that this person has mental illness, is an anti-Semite and worships Hitler. Like the guy is obsessed with Hitler apparently. And like he's mentally ill.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what more do you need to know? He's told you who he is.
But importantly, you just said Kanye West should be allowed to go out and say whatever he wants. Agreed. And that private companies can then choose to platform or not platform that speech. Okay. Yep. That is literally how it's supposed to work. That is the government going away and the marketplace functioning speech.
Totally.
What you don't want to do is let Bob or Jane tell you what you can and cannot say or hear or whatever, or how to run your business. That's what I'm afraid of. And I think that people want to be loving and caring towards each other. And we end up trying to solve speech by limiting it. And what we end up with is a mess consistently because no matter how much good faith you have in your government, someone else is going to win an election down the road and they are not going to agree with you. And you're going to give them a big old stick.
Yeah, exactly. Be careful. Because if you start tipping the scales and then you lose power, guess what? You just gave that weapon to the next administration and the next one and the next one. And who knows how they swing that kettlebell.
It's going to swing it right at your head is what they're going to do.
Yeah. Duck. All right. Listen, this has been a great first episode. We'll see you all on the next This Week in Startups. Everybody go follow at Alex and welcome him as co-host of the show.
Thank you, Jason.
Give us your notes. Let's get him some follows here. And I'm at Jason. ThisWeekInStartups.com is powered by Podcast AI. You can search the entire archive of, getting close to 2,000 episodes. And we will be doing two news programs a week. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. This is critical. And turn on the bell so that when we go live, you can know and get this breaking news. And you don't have to wait for the show to be edited and come out the next day. Two ways to win. All right. Great job, Alex. What a great first show. I enjoyed this.
Thank you. Yeah, absolute blast.
Total blast. I'm so glad you're here.
Ah, fun times.